I'm most grateful for the welcome, the opportunity to speak to people today, a collection of friends of the Bar Smith and book collectors. I hope we'll find some interest in what I've got to say. And doing the talk in the Bar Smith Library is a terrific opportunity, I thought, to talk about some of the particular books that are in the collection at Downing Street. And with Paul's assistance earlier on and others in the library, we've picked out some, not obviously the same editions of some of the books that have been donated to the library by various politicians in their time, but reproductions or copies of them. So perhaps at the end, if people want to come up and have a look, I've arranged them by their donor there. So the Prime Ministerial names imply that the Prime Ministers in question donated those books to the library. And that's obviously, again, a very small sample of what they offered up. Let me start by talking a bit about 10 Downing Street and the home, if you like, of that library. Downing Street is an address that is, I think, recognised almost instantly across the world. In the right context, just the words number 10 are enough really to conjure up images of the famous Black Door and scenes of prime ministers and world leaders passing through. And if I can see if this is going to work, no, it's not going to work. I'm going to have to stretch an arm from time to time. The Black Door, and I think I've got one of Thatcher and Reagan conducting one of their friendly press conferences outside the front of number 10. I'm sure everybody here has seen those images on the television. It's also the site of the very public arrival and departure of prime ministers at the beginning, at the end. Unlike the American system, where we wait several months for Obama to be sworn in, it's sudden death in England. And again, many of you will remember the scenes when Margaret Thatcher left in tears in a car as the votes became clear that she'd lost the leadership of the Conservative Party, and can contrast that with the extraordinary scenes when Tony Blair was welcomed to number 10 in 1997. The streets thronged with people, and as the tradition goes, all of the staff of number 10 coming out the front to applaud the new Prime Minister and family into the building. In fact, number 10 is a very small and a fairly nondescript house in Whitehall, and it's a very unlikely setting for the roles it fulfills. As well as the place of the official state receptions for foreign leaders, it's the site of the Prime Minister's offices and the supporting departments. So Prime Minister and Cabinet are based inside number 10. There is a direct connection through to the Cabinet Office, which fronts on to Whitehall. And it is also, of course, the residence of the Prime Minister and the family. It doesn't have anything like the grandeur of some of the other equivalent places elsewhere in the world. It doesn't have the grandeur of the White House in Washington. It doesn't have anything like the setting of Kirribilli. It doesn't have the space or the facilities of the principal executive buildings that house many governments. It certainly doesn't offer the luxury that many world leaders would expect in their living quarters. The accommodation is fairly cramped and not especially comfortable. Cramped to the point that when Blair was living there, he in fact lived at the flat above number 11 next door, and Gordon Brown, while he was Chancellor, lived in the flat at number 10 because he had a much smaller family. Nevertheless, since 1732, this building has been at the heart of British politics, and except for very rare times during the Second World War, during times of bombing, or during renovations and repairs, notably in the very early 1960s, the Cabinet Room has been the place where all of the key government decisions that have shaped Britain and the rest of the world, in many respects, have taken place. What we now call number 10 is, in fact, three separate buildings that were given to Robert Walpole by George II in 1732. Today, we think of Walpole as the first Prime Minister of Britain, but he was, in fact, given the building in his capacity as First Lord of the Treasury. And so the detail on the front of the Black Door still has the brass plate indicating First Lord of the Treasury. For most of the time since 1732, both the titles, Prime Minister is a title that, in fact, wasn't used much until the middle of the 19th century. But the person that we now think of as the Prime Minister also held the title First Lord of the Treasury, in most instances, not all. So most of the 51 prime ministers that have followed Walpole have held both titles, but the last exception to that was Lord Salisbury, who was prime minister from 1895 to 1902. And while he was prime minister, it was the first Lord of the Treasury, the last one of which was his nephew, Robert Balfour, who lived at number 10, and Balfour succeeded Salisbury and simply stayed on there. And since Balfour's time, all of the prime ministers have also been First Lord of the Treasury. Over the years, the different spaces have been used for different purposes, and there's a rather lovely illustration here from the 1950s, prepared late 40s, 1950s, that shows the back of number 10, that's Downing Street in the far distance on the left, it's a sort of an open view of the back looking south, back across towards... back towards Admiralty Arch along the other end of Whitehall. Today, most of the ground floor is used as offices, and you can see there the offices here are now used for secretaries of the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister has an office in here, I think it is now. This is the Cabinet Room and has been the Cabinet Room for the whole of the time. These first floor rooms are state rooms where the receptions are held, and there's a dining room further around here, and the upper level is now the private accommodation for the Prime Minister's family. As I say, different times those rooms have been used for different purposes, but the one constancy through that has been the Cabinet Room looking north, it is, or we're looking south. Looking out of that building would be looking north. At the northwest corner of the ground floor is the Cabinet Room. And I think I've got a shot of the interior of the Cabinet Room. Inside that room, there's little ornamentation. There's the large, depending upon your political mood at the time, a boat-shaped or coffin-shaped table that was introduced by Macmillan that replaced an earlier rectangular table. Macmillan wanted a table of that shape so that he could see all of the ministers as they were gathered at the table rather than have to crane forward to look upon to his left and right. There are those chairs are there, and the illustrations that you'll see later indicate that those chairs have been there for well over 100 years. The Prime Minister's chair now is at the back against the fireplace, and when the room's not occupied, the Prime Minister's chair is always left out from the table at a slight angle, and it's the only chair in the room with arms. So there's some benefits of being Prime Minister. There are two clocks in the room. I think if I go back, we can see where we were before. There's a clock above the mantelpiece. Harold Wilson had a clock installed on the wall on the other side, so he could also tell the time without craning around and twisting his neck. And that portrait there above the fireplace is of Walpole. And you can just make out in the distance that there are two bookcases up at the far end of the Cabinet Room beyond those pillars. And that's a shot of some of the contents of those bookcases. Inside those cases are now part of a collection that is known as the Prime Minister's Library, and obviously that's what I'm going to be talking about for the remainder of my time today, the origins of that library and the insights that it can give us about British politics through the 20th century. The library dates from the 1930s, when Ramsay MacDonald was Prime Minister of Britain for the second time. He was the first Labor Prime Minister, and he'd served a very short time as Prime Minister in 1924, lost office at the end of 24, and had been re-elected in 1929. When MacDonald arrived at Downing Street, he was unlike nearly all of his predecessors, Liberal or Conservative, stretching back for nearly 200 years. MacDonald was the illegitimate son of a housemaid and a Scottish crofter. He grew up in the north of Scotland in Lossiemouth and had come to London as a young man in 1886. He worked in a variety of jobs and gradually became more active in Labour political groups and was elected to the Commons as a Labour MP in 1906. And then as the character of British politics changed during and after World War I, particularly with the passage of the Reform Act in 1918, which gave universal male suffrage, women and also enfranchised women over the age of 30, women between 21 and 30 had to wait till 1928, that was the so-called flapper vote. That was granted in 1928. But the Reform Act of 1918 obviously changed the character of British politics because it gave the vote to many, many more people. Support for Labour grew, and following an inconclusive election result in 1923, MacDonald headed the first minority Labour government. Again, unlike his predecessors, he came to Downing Street with very limited resources of his own. And at that time, almost bizarrely, the Prime Minister of the day could expect to find all of the furniture that was needed at No. 10, but had to supply his own linen, crockery, glassware, decorations, etc. And the division between what was a state responsibility and what was a personal responsibility is a debate going back really to Disraeli's time, when Disraeli had spent a long time not living at No. 10. When he, as his health deteriorated, moved back to No. 10, there was a constant fight between the Prime Minister of the day and the government over what would be regarded as state expenditure and what was personal. MacDonald, for example, had to pay for the household staff. He employed a housekeeper and five servants. He had to pay for the coal that was used to heat the residential sections of the building, but the heating of the public rooms was covered by the state. One of the consequences of this is that the MacDonald family took most of their meals in the public, in official dining room to avoid the cost of heating their own area. I'll let that slur go past, Anne. MacDonald's background meant that he did not have the same capacity as others to fit out Downing Street. In his study of MacDonald, Harold Wilson, a later Labor Prime Minister, wrote, "No future Prime Minister before or since has come so far from such obscure beginnings." When he first became Prime Minister in 1924, as I said, it was at the head of a minority Labor government, and MacDonald did not expect to remain in office very long. He was therefore very reluctant to spend much money on furnishings, and his diary shows that he was genuinely concerned about the financial impact of being Prime Minister and the personal expense he'd have to face. He was on a salary of about £5,000, but as I say, he had to employ his own staff and was expected to fit out Downing Street to a fair degree. His first step then was to send his daughter Ishbel, his wife had died some years earlier, his first step was to send his daughter Ishbel off to the January sales to buy a variety of ornaments to install in Downing Street. And she came back with a whole lot of vases and plate. And again, her letters make it clear that she was spending a £50 inheritance that she'd got and was saving for other purposes rather unwillingly. Another initiative was to approach the National Gallery to supply some pictures. The only ones in Downing Street were portraits of prime ministers. But the one thing that MacDonald couldn't supply or borrow was a collection of books. And in fact, as we saw, his expectation of a short stay in government as Prime Minister was well-founded. The first Labor government lasted just 9 months. MacDonald was out of office and out of Downing Street by November 1924. When he returned as Prime Minister 5 years later in 1929, he was in a much more secure political position. Labor still formed a minority government, but it was for the first time the largest single party, and there were reasons to expect it to stay in office for a longer period. So during his second term as Prime Minister, MacDonald set about creating a library at No. 10. There were two reasons why he thought a library would be a useful addition. The first was a fairly prosaic one. There was simply no reference collection in the building. And there are lots of accounts from Baldwin's time of the 1920s when staff were working on speeches, had to leave No. 10 and walk down to the Houses of Parliament to check a library, check a book in the Parliamentary Library for a quotation or some facts or figures. There's a story of one of Baldwin's staff. He was Prime Minister from 23 to 24, then 24 to 29 and 35 to 37. One of his staff using Baldwin's own London Library card and having an argument at the desk trying to borrow a book on the Prime Minister's card so that he could check a quotation. I'm not sure if that happens here very often, Mark. And one other staffer reported that he regularly had to go off to his club at about lunchtime to check a reference. So having a permanent collection at No. 10 obviously made sense and had some utilitarian value. MacDonald's second justification for the library was that he wanted a collection of books slightly more stimulating to read than copies of Hansard. MacDonald was quoted in a newspaper explaining his views. "There's nothing more wearing than for a Prime Minister never to be able to get away from the everlasting atmosphere of minutes, dispatches, committees, conferences and interviews. If he is fortunate to have an hour's leisure time, there is nothing homely in No. 10 Downing Street. When the Prime Minister goes to the bookshelves, they contain little else but Hansard. His table contains nothing but official papers. I tried in 1924 to get some pictures on the wall, walls other than portraits of Prime Ministers. Since then, I have been trying to get furniture which shall belong to No. 10 permanently. Now I am turning my attention to the library." We know from contemporary accounts that the cabinet room held nothing but copies of Hansard maps and parliamentary papers and illustrations of the room before the state that Macmillan effectively left it in the early 60s show that the walls contained uniform cases of books. And again, I've got a few of these to work through. The first is a cabinet from 1867. Darby is the Prime Minister standing on the right, and those bookcases on either side of the fireplace are obviously still in place right up until the 1950s. Disraeli, in the sort of middle on the right, as adopting the more regular pattern of the Prime Minister sitting with desks at the fireplace. You can see the rectangular table there. But you can also, if you've got good eyesight, see beyond the pillars at the back that there's no bookcases against that far wall. But there are bookcases against the window, against the wall with the windows. And again, Gladstone's cabinet shows a room surrounded by bookcases. Gladstone, unusually, is not sitting in the normal Prime Minister's spot. He's walking in on the right here. And a rather nice painting of the cabinet room in 1907 from where the bookcases are looking the other way. And you can see the rectangular table very clearly. You can just make out the Prime Minister's chair with the arms on the left there. Baldwin turned the cabinet room into something completely different. And I still can't explain this picture because it's from 1927. We know it was Baldwin's administration. I suspect it was during a time when the cabinet was not meeting regularly and Baldwin effectively had the room reconfigured almost as a sort of a comfortable study. And those who've done any work on Baldwin would know comfort and a spot to sit and read would be probably just as important as chairing a cabinet meeting. So he obviously felt that was the way it should be, but I don't think it spent long in that configuration. Then, to finish off, a photo of Clem Attlee and Ernest Bevin in the cabinet room, August 1945. They're actually about to announce the end of the Pacific War there with the microphones set up on the cabinet table, about to do a national broadcast. But again, you can still see the bookcases in the background by the fireplace behind Bevin. MacDonald's solution to the rather unpromising literature was borrowed in part from an idea first advanced by one of Baldwin's secretaries who was complaining he'd been unable to find a copy of the Bible anywhere in number 10 when he wanted to quote it. He went off and asked all of the current and living former cabinet members to donate a book that was in some way special to them, by them, or by one of their family, about them, or politically significant to them. And in time, he said that collection would build and become a valuable historical record. And as MacDonald explained in the letter that went out soliciting donations, if contribution to the library is thus confined to those associated with the cabinet room in successive ministries and to gifts of one or at least a few books in each individual case, the library, although it will grow more slowly, will be much richer in sentiment and tradition. Had such a library, for instance, been started and carefully managed since the time when No. 10 Downing Street became the official residence of the Prime Minister, there would now be a collection of books of incalculable historical interest and value. You can see in that MacDonald is quite clear at that stage that the collection should be made up only of those who effectively work in the cabinet room, the ministers, not a general collection of text gathered in various ways. By early 1931, MacDonald had written to all his ministers explaining the scheme and suggesting that if donors did not have a specific book in mind, he could supply a list of appropriate titles. His enthusiasm for the collection is remarkable, I think. The first call for books went out in early 1931, the darkest days of the Depression, and only months before the Labor government fell and a national coalition was formed. During that time, MacDonald found time to fuss over the design of the book plate, arranged for the collection to be held in the cabinet room, badgered his colleagues and former colleagues into making donations, and responded with polite rejections to various well-meaning letters he got and other self-interested offers from others to contribute. So there were a lot of people heard about this library and wrote in saying, I've got a good book for the number 10 library, and he made it clear that it was limited. There were two letters also from well-known booksellers offering to supply any number of books at a discount rate should the Prime Minister want them. We can get a feel for MacDonald's mood at this time from some of the files and papers that are still held at number 10 discussing the origins of the library. One of his staff, I think with great insensitivity, wrote about a minor aspect of the library in May 1931, and started by suggesting that MacDonald might like to consider a number of issues while he had a time of comparative leisure. A week before this, when writing in his diary, MacDonald had noted, I now have to consider some reconstruction of the cabinet and am so overworked that I ought to reconstruct myself out of it. In a letter written 5 days after that, he complained that, quote, after 2 years of heavy drudgery, I am more tired in body and mind than anybody knows. Clearly, comparative leisure is a relative term, I think. There can be no doubt that MacDonald had no leisure time in 1931, as the economic and political consequences of the Depression were taking a huge toll on the government. And the cabinet would, in fact, split, as I said, in August, and MacDonald would emerge as Prime Minister of a national coalition. Given this, I think we can get a sense of the commitment that he had to the library as he continued to write to former ministers encouraging donations. And it's also clear that he had a very firm idea of what the collection should look like. He suggested that if ministers had not written books themselves, then the standard works on, this is a quote, standard works on history, economics, lives of statesmen, the classics in prose and poetry, and so on, close quote, would be appropriate selections. And the letter concludes by asking ministers to advise him of their proposed donation so as to avoid duplicates or inappropriate additions. Eventually, invitations went out to all the living cabinet members from previous governments, and that stretched back to a couple of members of Salisbury's last administration that had fallen, been dissolved in 1902. Since then, until 1997, most cabinet members in subsequent administrations have been invited to contribute a volume. And overall, from 1902, the living ones from 1902, up to and including all members of the John Major government that finished in 1997, there have been 357 eligible cabinet members, and of those, there are records of donations from 242 of them. That's about two-thirds. I've been able to trace a total of 673 books in the collection, but there's some evidence that some donations have been lost. There are lists held in the files, and I've not been able to find the book, so it's really impossible now to know exactly how many books had been given. Today, only a small portion of that total collection, books beginning with authors beginning A to C, are held in the cases in the cabinet room. Most of the collection is held in crates in storage in various parts of the basement of Number 10. And I think the fact that that is the case reflects that over the years, enthusiasm for the collection has waxed and waned. There are long gaps in the files when nothing was done, then bursts of letters seeking donations, and different prime ministers clearly gave the library a very different priority. There were notable periods of growth while Clement Attlee was prime minister in 1945 to 51, and again under Thatcher, 79 to 90, but little evidence for enthusiasm for the library from the mid-50s under conservative prime ministers until... and including, really, Harold Wilson's Labor administration in the mid-1960s. During Ted Heath's time as Prime Minister, there were suggestions that the library should be... It became the subject of a whole series of speculative questions in the Commons. Norman Tebbit, who was then an unknown backbencher, subsequently a minister in the Thatcher government, specialised in asking questions about how much is the government spending on political memoirs of various people as a means of sort of cutting back on public expenditure, and then would use it as a supplementary question to suggest that, there's a rather lovely way he puts it, that if anyone's buying the Harold Wilson book, which is over there on the account of his government, it would be useful to get a copy which is bound without a spine to reflect the quality of the author. And if possible, get a loose leaf one so that later, you know, it could be altered later on to suit the record. So there was a bit of interest in the library in the 1970s. One of Heath's administrative staff suggested the library should be opened up and made more general, and that specific purchases should supplement the gifts. But Heath resisted that proposal. I think it would have changed the character and the nature of the library completely. Since she left office in 1990, Margaret Thatcher... there have been donations from members of the major cabinet, but none so far from either of Tony Blair or Gordon Brown's administrations. And as far as I know, there's no intention to secure them. Each time a donation is made, a signed bookplate is added to the book, and there is a copy of the bookplate that was specially commissioned by William Rothenstein, who was the principal of the Royal College of Art. And the quotation at the top was commissioned by Henry Newbolt, famous poet. And I'm very grateful for Jackie Clark in our classics department here for helping me with the translation. She suggests the translation is, the library is a haven and refuge for those toiling. And it might be also that there's a bit of a pun on it being originally a Labor Prime Minister with the opening word there. The apostrophe is a good question. There is no apostrophe there. Yes, and I think that everybody just sort of fudged it and decided, well, is it the Prime Minister's library or the library of the Prime Minister at the time? Normally when people are typing messages, they put the apostrophe before the S to indicate it's there's only one Prime Minister at a time and it is that person's library. As I said, book plates are signed. There's Churchill and Nye Bevan signing their works. And so when we can decipher the signature, we can work out who gave what book. And after some considerable detective work, I'm pretty confident I've been able to work out all but one of the signatures. I'll set that as a challenge to you later. And of course, there's lots of stories in the list of ministers who chose whether or not to make a donation and the choice that they made. Far too many, obviously, for me to run through all of them, but let me give you briefly a feel for some of them. From the Macdonald government in 29 to 31, most members gave something. Macdonald gave three books. We've got, I think, two of the three over there, or copies of them. One's a collection of his speeches and the other is a biography of his wife, who died some years earlier. Not the standard histories and classics then that he was suggesting other ministers might want to give. The first female cabinet member in Britain, Margaret Bonfield, gave a collection of poetry, a couple of books, a collection of poetry. Other notable donors were Wedgwood Benn, that's Tony Benn's father, who was in that government, and Sidney Webb, who by then was Lord Parsfield, the famous social reformer. Intriguingly, two of the ministers who split from Labor with Macdonald and went to the National Coalition chose never to give a book to the library, whereas many of the Labor ministers who stayed loyal to Labor and obviously had a big falling out with Macdonald subsequently did make a donation. I think it's I haven't quite worked out the politics of that. The national government that followed was dominated by Conservatives. Baldwin eventually followed Macdonald as Prime Minister, gave several volumes of his own speeches. But in that administration, remarkably, Malcolm Macdonald, son of Ramsay, who was in the cabinet from 35 to 40, did not contribute anything to the library that his father had initiated. Neville Chamberlain was Prime Minister from 37 to 40. He gave a copy of The Struggle for Peace, that speeches he'd given during the appeasement debates in the lead-up to the war. Churchill, obviously Prime Minister during the Second World War in between 51 and 55, had served in most cabinets. He first went into the cabinet in 1908 under Asquith and left the cabinet in 1955, just under 50 years. Not continuous, but a pretty fair record nonetheless. He gave his own three-volume biography of his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, and he gave a copy of The World Crisis, and we've got a copy of that over there. Attlee gave Purpose and Policy, I have to admit, fairly boring speeches that were published. Anthony Eden is the only Prime Minister since Macmillan never to have given anything to the library. Harold Macmillan gave a wonderful set of Kipling, 23 volumes, a complete collection of Kipling. We've got a sample of titles there. They're a beautiful uniform set bound in red, of course, published by Macmillan, the family publishing company of which he was a director, so I don't suppose he had much trouble getting his hands on them. He also gave a copy of Middle Way, which is one of the most important economic texts of the 1930s when Macmillan is setting out his alternative social and economic policies during the Depression. Douglas Hume, Harold Wilson, Heath, Calhoun, Thatcher and Major all gave books, but none certainly as yet from Blair or Brown. Most of the ones from those Prime Ministers, I suppose, are fairly predictable. Harold Wilson's given an account of his own government and a study of Prime Ministers that he wrote. Ted Heath gave some rather wonderful illustrated volumes on carol music and on music in general and on sailing, of course. But also Dicey's Introduction to the Study of Law of the Constitution, which I think is an interesting choice. Callaghan gave Francis Williams The Pattern of Rulers, we've got over there. Thatcher, as a Minister for Science and the Heath government, gave Discoveries of Space, which is the large book on the table by her name, but also her account of The Path to Power and the Downing Street years. John Major gave um, a, 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 I have read it, a dreadfully boring speech on the Europe, a Future That Works, delivered in 1994. But more interestingly, two books written by his wife, Joan Norma Major, a biography of Joan Sutherland, and an illustrated history of Chequers, the Prime Minister's country house, which is over there. Other ones that sort of I always find intriguing are sort of, for me, it's the political statements that we're seeing in the books. Beaverbrook, for example, who had been a minister in both the First World War and the Second World War, gave the works of Edmund Burke. John Biffin, who was a Thatcher minister, gave a book about Enoch Powell. Fairly controversial choice at the time. Michael Forsyth, also worked in the Thatcher ministry, gave Hayek's Road to Serfdom. Perhaps not so surprising. Jim Griffiths, who was an Attlee minister and with Nye Bevan, really one of the key architects of the post-war welfare state, gave a book by Ivor Jennings on cabinet government. What was he saying about Attlee's administration, I wonder? Robert Sanders, who was in Baldwin's government, gave a beautiful set of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And there's lots of books about liberalism, labour values and conservative ideas. Ernest Bevin, who we saw a photo of earlier, didn't give a book at all, but there's a book about him donated to the collection. Eden didn't give a book, as I mentioned, but there's a biography of him donated. And probably the most puzzling for me, Michael Foote, who was leader of the Labour Party and a minister, who has written some wonderful political history, British political history. His books are in the library, but he didn't donate anything to it. And again, he's about 98 now. Perhaps I should write and ask why not. Let me finish and look forward to some questions you might have with two further stories. The first is of a minister, a man called Jack Diamond, who was a fairly undistinguished member of the Wilson government. I don't mean that in any rude way. He was Chief Secretary of the Treasury from 64 to 70. He was in cabinet only between 68 and 1970. He'd come into the Commons in 1945 and he'd lost his seat in 1951 at the election that Churchill defeated the Attlee government. He was re-elected in 1957 and was defeated and lost his seat in 1970. He then went to the Lords as Lord Diamond, where he left the Labor Party and joined the SDP in the early 1980s. And then when the SDP merged with the Liberals, he left them and rejoined Labor. He died in 2004, aged 96. The book that Diamond donated to the library was a book that many of you will recognise. This is not the edition, but The Ragged-Trousered Philanthropists. Written by Robert Noonan, who, of course, was writing as a pseudonym Robert Tressel. I've got a copy of it here, which is much less exciting than the illustration I've got up there. Those of you who have read it will know it is a searing indictment of the conditions experienced by working men and women in pre-World War I England. Low wages, exploitative conditions, the ever-present threat of the workhouse, and it's now regarded as a classic of British working class writing and its wide distribution through the Workers' Education Association at the end of World War II is sometimes thought to have contributed to the victory that Attlee secured, rather surprisingly, against the Poles, or not against the Poles, against the expectations in 1945. There is an edition that Alan Sillitoe has written an introduction to saying basically that book won the 1945 election. It's a significant book for anyone from the left in England, and it was very important to Diamond's generation. It seems, at one level, an odd book for one of Wilson's ministers. I don't think Wilson was on the far left of the Labor Party, and one who was in the Wilson administration and then drifted to the SDP. But I suppose it says much about his political journey. The second one to pick out is the donation made by Ken Clark. Clark was in the cabinet from 1985 to 1997, so he served under both Thatcher and Major. In his time, he was Home Secretary. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer. He stood for the leadership of the Conservative Party on three separate times and lost to William Hague, Ian Duncan Smith and David Cameron. He was first brought into the cabinet, as I said, by Margaret Thatcher. And Thatcher, as you will know, was a leader who believed in strong, clear and firm leadership. She detested compromise and consensus. There's a fabulous quote from a speech she gave, in fact, at Monash University in Melbourne in the early 1980s, where she was wanting to reflect on consensus. She said, "To me, consensus seems to be the process of abandoning all beliefs, principles, values and policies in search of something in which no one believes, but to which no one objects. The process of avoiding the very issues that have to be solved merely because you cannot get agreement on the way ahead. What great cause would have been fought and won under the banner, "I stand for consensus"? The book that Clark donated was a biography of Stanley Baldwin, which we've got here. And again, I couldn't find a copy of the cover of it, so I've got a picture of Baldwin sitting almost in the identical spot to Clem Attlee, shortly after him, at the edge of the fireplace with microphones, doing a broadcast from the cabinet room. Baldwin was three times Prime Minister, as I've mentioned, and he's thought by most historians to be one of the most consensual, certainly the most consensual Conservative Prime Minister of the 20th century. Surely Clark was delivering a clear but gentle message to Thatcher when he selected that particular book for the library. Not all of the books, but most of them, I think, tell a story. And the more I look at the listings, the more I discover. So as Anne was suggesting, this will be a labour that I can just sort of keep picking up and putting down and finding more and more observations to make. But that's probably enough for tonight. But let me leave you. I'm very happy to buy a very large glass of something for the person who can decipher the signature at the bottom of that book plate. I'll leave it up.
Need a
chemist was the call from the front. That's the one signature I've not been able to decipher. Thank you.